Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Grows from your scalp,
not from the ends, as some people may think.
And yes, people do.
So
before you question yourself on that, no, they do. They actually do. All right.
It always shocks me when we have to go over something like that. But there are some people who believe it grows from the ends, and I can understand why you might think that it would grow from the end.
Anyway, yes, your hair grows from your scalp,
which is why you get roots.
Yes. I can't think of anything to add to that.
Hair grows from your scalp, man.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Yes. All right. What are we learning about today?
We're going to get in our Wayback Machine, and we're going to go back to June 10th of 1861. Now, you might say to yourself, ooh, 1861, that's a rough time for Appalachia. Civil War starting. You would be correct. And today we're going to talk about the first ever combat submarine. And like I said, we are going to June 10, 1861. This is when Reverend Franklin Smith publishes an article in the Columbia Herald calling for the development of submarine warfare. He says that he needs some Southern businessmen to rally up some money and get this project on the road. He said it must be, and this is quote, must be cigar-shaped for speed, made out of plate iron joined without external rivet heads. So he already knew. He was like, if it's going to be watertight, we can't have no external rivet head. It has to be 30 foot long with a central section approximately 4 foot by 3 foot. So not a big chamber.
I can't quit laughing because I just looked at a picture of this and it looks like something that Casper's dad would have. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, back then, like it's going to be.
It's a clunker.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has to be driven by a spiral propeller. He puts this article out and he's like, all right. If you put the article, they will come, right? One man did come. Horace Lawson Hunley. He is born actually in Sumner County, Tennessee in 1823. He joins the Louisiana Bar in 1841 and establishes a practice in New Orleans. Big city going on down there?
Yeah, especially at that time.
Booming. He owned a small plantation with slaves. However, he didn't really fuck with the war. He thought it was kind of dumb. He's just really doing this for the money. He thinks, hey, if I can make the submarine, I can invest this little bit of money, and then they're going to buy them from me.
So, like, you know what I mean? This is how I'm making money for my goal.
Yeah. Okay. So, the goal was not to further the Confederate Army. The goal was to make money off the Confederate Army.
He's a capitalist.
Yeah. He is providing some financial backing in return for money on the return. Right. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, he says, I got you, big dog. He establishes two other supporters, and he finds an engineer by the name of McClintock. In the fall of 61, they get this project blueprints drawn up and everything. The first prototype tests are in February of 1862. It's called the Pioneer. It's 35 feet long. It's 4 foot wide. It's round. And it's run by a three-man crew.
So were they completely inventing this technology? Had there ever been any type of submarines like this?
I think at this point there are diving suits.
Okay.
And I think that there may be like small, like things you can sit in that they can lower into the water.
Okay.
But I don't believe that there's like a full submarine yet.
Okay.
This is the whole pioneering of submarine warfare.
Okay.
Okay. And so you have one pilot and you got two crew to like crank the
by hand.
They're cranking it by hand in a 4-foot chamber.
The smell.
Horrendous. Okay, so this does have some success. I don't think they sink this one fully. So they're like, fuck yeah, let's go. So then April 25th of 62, New Orleans comes under siege from
the Civil War.
From Union troops. Yeah. And they are forced to scuttle the Pioneer. So they're forced to like break it up and sink it so that the Union can't get a hold of it. So that's number one out of there. Side note, the Union is able to raise the Pioneer by 1868 and sold that motherfucker for scrap. Diabolical.
Yeah.
Diabolical.
I love there was two guys that was like, you know, there's a submarine down here.
Hey, brother.
Yeah.
You know what's down there?
You think we can get this up?
I bet you we could. And they did.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then Hundley and McClintock, they hightail it out of New Orleans and they head for Mobile, Alabama, which is the next fort over. We're headed to Fort Morgan, basically. And they build a new sub called the American Diver. There were, on this one, attempts to replace the hand crank with an engine. But the problem, I think, became that you still had to have a pilot in there. And the byproduct
that's
of
what
the
I
engine,
say, like, how would you be able to filter that out?
Yeah, it was that
because they were like burning like cold, hard fossil fuels back then.
Exactly. Or steam. And steam would have boiled you out of there because you're in an iron tube. So and the size of the engine, they couldn't generate enough power to get it going fast enough.
Oh, yeah, because that would be heavy.
Going through the water. So with men, they can slow it up or they can slow it, speed it up, whatever they need to do. So, yeah, the whole engine thing is scrapped, and they're towing this thing through some rough waters one day, and it don't make it.
I can just imagine.
It sinks off Fort Morgan in February of 1863. The crew does survive this one.
Good.
That sub, actually, the exact location of that one, nobody knows where it's at. Nobody knows. Still haven't found it to this day.
I love that.
At this point, we're running out of money. Because we've made a couple subs now, and they're sunk.
And that has to be so expensive, just the metal alone.
Exactly. So they go, and they find a little more financial backing in the Singer's Secret Service Corps, who is like a group of Confederate engineers.
Okay.
And so they got a little bit of money, so they're going to bring the backing to this project. And they're also going to come and be like, I want to put my name on one. You know what I mean? Now, in April of 1863, construction begins on the actual H.L. Hundley at Parks and Lyon Machine Shop in Mobile, Alabama. This one's the biggest one yet. She's 40 foot long. She, in the middle, is a 25 foot long crew chamber.
Oh, okay.
So we've got, but it's not very tall still. But it is run on a 7-to-8-man crew. You got a captain, and then you got 7 to crank.
That's ambitious.
That is putting out some power.
Just the weight of those men alone.
Yes. Well, and it's designed to fully dive down below a target, and they were towing on a fucking rope. A contact bomb, a mine. And they would go under and they would tow it. And so that the mine
would
be floating.
Them.
And so it would hit the side of the ship and blow up. And they would be on the other side of the ship and just keep going. Right?
I mean, I see the idea there.
Yeah.
That makes...
Because like we don't have propelled torpedoes at this
right.
point. Right. This is a torpedo.
Right.
And so July 31st, 1863. We're in 63 now. So this is 2 years past when we first started this little venture. 1863, the Hunley debuts. Tows a contact mine by rope up to a barge, dives beneath, hits the barge, sinks it. Onlooking crowd is like, hell yeah, brother. And officials formally recommend the sub for combat. They call up Beauregard and they're like, hey, you want a submarine? And he's like, yeah, dude. And so they are going to ship it all the way over to Charleston, South Carolina by train with a tarp over it. And there's armed guards on the train so that nobody can come get it.
I don't know what could go wrong.
They get it there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They get it there.
Okay. So you got to think, too, that was like a spectacle going through some towns.
Well, they've got it completely covered, so they can't tell what's under
that tarp. Even then, you know, they had to be like, whoa, do you see that thing on the train track?
What is that? That's right. At this point, it's got the nickname the fish boat because it can go underwater. Yeah. And Charleston at the time is under a big blockade. And it's basically strangling the South. No goods can come in or out of that Charleston Harbor, which is the main hub to go up and down the coast right there. And so with nothing getting in or out of there, it's bad news bears for the Confederates. Right. Because they have ironclads on there. So these are completely iron-hulled ships where cannons ain't doing...
Yeah, you can't do anything to
them. Doing fuck all to one of these, yeah. Right? So they're like, we're going to send the Hunley and blow these things
up.
Which, great, yeah, whoo, let's do that. So August of 1863, she gets shipped on down to Charleston. And at this point, so you remember our good buddy McClintock?
Yeah.
The engineer? He would receive $100,000 at that time, which is $2.3 million now. If the sub sank one of the Union warships.
He was like the Elon Musk of the 1800s.
He was. And so August 29th, 1863, is the first sinking of the Hunley. The Hunley begins to dive. See, there's a couple of different stories about how this happened. Okay.
Okay.
Either A, the Hunley began to, somebody accidentally knocked a lever or something, and it begins to dive with its hatches open.
What an unfortunate mistake.
Big, big, bad mistake. Or there is a wake or a wave from a passing ship that, with its hatches open, it takes on so much water that, like, it starts to sink. It's one of the two. And anyway,
either way, it was the hatch.
We're sinking.
Yeah.
There's 8 crew total. There's Michael Crane, Nicholas Davis, Frank Doyle, John Kelly, Absalom Williams. They do not make it.
Oh, no.
When they are found, they have to be physically cut out of the sub before it is raised to get their bodies out. 3 survivors this time. Lieutenant John Payne survived because he was standing on top of the sub and simply jumped off. He gets the fuck out of there. William Robinson was able to escape the aft hatch before the sub went down. Charlie Hasker rode that thing to the bottom. His leg was caught in the hatch and it hit the bottom and finally released the pressure and he was able to swim to the top.
That's wild.
He is the only man who ever rode it to the bottom. And he actually recorded his account in 1914.
I would tell everybody I ever came
he
into did. Contact
with. He said, I rode that thing to the bottom. Lieutenant Payne, remember our guy that jumped off the top of the sub? It's the crew's fault. The crew messed up. It wasn't the sub's fault. It was the crew's fault. And he says, hey, let me pick my own crew next time.
It sounds like these hatches need some type of safety feature, but
what do we know? We're just girls.
Right.
And so they're like, all right, you can pick your own crew this time. October 15th of 1863, we have the second sinking. Everyone dies this time. Hunley himself is the captain this time. We have Robert Brockbank, Joseph Patterson, Charles Hugh, McHugh. I don't know which one. Okay. I've seen it spelled both ways. Charles L. Sprague, John Marshall, Henry Baird, Thomas W. Park. The Hunley goes beneath the surface and just does not come back up.
Was it supposed to go under the surface?
Yes.
Okay.
It dives. It like takes off, dives the way it's supposed to, doesn't come back up.
Okay.
Due to rough seas, the Navy is not able to raise the ship until November the 7th. So we're going October 15th to November the 7th.
Yeah.
When they get it back up, they open the hatch. Everyone is still just right in their position where they were when they dove. They're all sitting in their seats.
That's eerie.
It's like, so what had happened was the forward ballast tank had been left open. So it was taking on water.
Okay.
The wrench for that was actually in the floor. They think by the time anybody realized that something was wrong, it was already too late.
Yeah.
So yeah, they just sunk.
That's wild.
So again, they clean this thing out.
Oh my God. I mean, after twice, you have to learn a lesson at that point.
Well, funny you should say that. Because February 17th of 1864, we have the third and final sinking of the H.L. Hunley.
Its namesake has already went down with the ship, and I would take that as the biggest omen you possibly could.
Well, General Beauregard himself said, "This thing poses more of a threat to us than it does to the enemy."
Literally, though.
And he was going to have it decommissioned, but they basically talked him into, "We can use it. I know we can use it. We'll stay on the surface." And he was like, "Okay, if you stay on the surface, we can use it." So they retrofit it to, and this is the dumbest shit I've ever heard in my life. They put a 20-foot wooden spar on the front, strapped a bomb to it, and it was supposed to just hit a ship, and when it pulled back, it was supposed to, like, release the bomb.
We were still learning bomb technology at that point.
Who put men in charge? Well, at approximately 8:40 p.m., the Hunley launches, and the target is the USS Housatonic. They go out of Sullivan's Island, South Carolina. That's down there in Charleston. Yeah. The crew of the Housatonic's going about their night, doing their thing. And they see this faint glow in the water. And everybody's, "What is that?" "I don't know." "You know?" "No, I don't know." Then by the time they realize that, oh, shit, this is something we need to be worried about, it's too late. They got hit. Bomb blows up. The Housatonic sinks in 5 minutes.
Oh.
So it was a successful hit. Yeah. That's why the H.L. Hunley is the first successful submarine combat mission. Housatonic loses 5 of its 155 crew members. I didn't get a list of who those guys were. Nowhere is that listed. Unfortunately, I don't have. Witnesses say that the Hunley signals to the shore crew, who is supposed to light the fire so they can, like a lighthouse.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So they can go, okay, this is where we're going.
Right.
And so they send up a blue signal. It was a blue light that they were supposed to shine, and then they were supposed to light the fire. Everybody saw that almost an hour after the sinking of the Housatonic. However, the Hunley never returned.
Oh.
In November of 1864, the first search by the U.S. Navy, so we're talking Union troops, starts. So they deem the Housatonic unsalvageable. We're going to scrap it. Because it basically sunk up to its rigging, and then a lot of the sailors, like, climbed up.
Oh, okay. So like a ghost ship thing where it just, like, halfway under.
Because I think it only sank in 30 foot of water. So. And then they drag over a quarter mile of the seafloor around the Housatonic to try to find
where it would be.
Because they know the Hunley never came back up at this point. They know that. Can't find it. Nobody can find it. The Hundley quickly becomes stuff of legend. You know what I mean? Even P.T. Barnum offers a $100,000 reward for the shipwreck of the Hundley. And it remains a mystery completely until May 3rd, 1995.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Author Clive Cussler and his team find the submarine in roughly 30 foot of water off the coast of Sullivan's Island. And it was pointing it was in a straight line from the wreck of the Housatonic to Sullivan's Island. It was in that direct path. And August 8th, 2000, the Hundley is finally raised again. And the way that they did it is they went in, they prepared the site, they dug out from around it and put straps underneath it, and then brought it up like a whale or a dolphin.
Oh, yeah.
And then they put it in a freshwater tank because it's been underwater all these years. Anytime that it's exposed to air,
it's going to start to corrode. Yeah.
And so they put it in a freshwater tank and carted it back to the lab, so to speak.
Yeah.
And forensics got inside the Hundley after all this time. And they were able to find out quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy.
There were, all the men's stuff was still in there. The entire 8-man crew was recovered from the sub. There seemed to be no effort made to escape, and there was no skeletal trauma present. There's been a lot of speculation of, they probably all died when the bomb went off. But then how did you signal an hour?
And how would you have been in a straight line moving away from the ship?
Some people think they just ran out of air because there was no air system in there. But the truth is, we'll never really know.
Yeah.
So I have the crew's breakdown. We had George Dixon, who was 5'9" tall. He had an athletic build and sandy blonde hair. He was American born, but not Southern, likely Midwestern.
Okay.
He had some wealth, and as evidence, he had gold fillings in his teeth. He was found with diamond jewelry and a gold watch. In 1860, we know he was a steamboat engineer. And he finds himself in Mobile at the beginning of the Civil War. He's a member of the Masonic Lodge there, and he joined a local police force there called the Grays. He enlists in the Confederate Army in 1861. In 1862, Dixon is at the Battle of Shiloh, Tennessee.
Oh.
Where he is shot, but his life is saved by a gold coin in his pocket. And rumor has it that a little girl gave it to him before he left as a good luck charm. And the coin is found with him in the submarine.
Wild.
Mm-hmm. We have Mr. Arnold Becker. He was only 5'5". He's approximately 20 years old. He's not born in America.
Okay.
His teeth show signs of malnutrition at a very young age. He's possibly working on a riverboat at the war's start. And his boat was bought by the Confederate Navy and refitted for combat. And it becomes the CSS General Polk. And October 19th, 1861 is when Becker joins the Confederate Navy.
Okay.
So he goes ahead and signs over. In June 26, 1862, the General Polk is intentionally set on fire to avoid capture.
Oh, no.
He survives. And then October of 1862, Becker is assigned to the CSS Chickareth, I think it is, and promoted to Captain's Cook, which I was like, what the fuck is that? It's an assistant to the captain.
Oh, okay.
It's not like first mate, but he's an assistant to the captain.
Okay.
He's assigned to the CSS Indian Chief, where he meets Lieutenant Dixon. And then we have Mr. C. Lumpkin. We only know his last name and a first initial. He's 5'10", and he's approximately 37 to 44 years old. He is European born, and he has an evidence of a life of a lot of hard work on his body. He had arthritis. He walked with a slouch. He had notches in his teeth where a pipe rested. And he was found with a pipe, a sewing kit, and a pocket knife. Next, we have Mr. Frank Collins. He was over 6 foot tall, so he's the largest crew member.
That also tells you a little bit about dimensions of how big this place was.
Oh, yeah. The crew chamber is not big. Yeah. So they're definitely picking smaller guys on purpose, which the average person wasn't that big during the Civil War right. to begin with. So, like, Frank Collins was a damn giant.
Yeah.
But just saying.
People probably knew him because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably call him Giant or something like that.
He was probably
Frank. Yeah, Big Frank. He was approximately 20 years old. He did not use tobacco, but he did have tailored notches from resting metal needles between his teeth when he was sewing. Yeah. He's born in Virginia, and his parents died when he was little, and so he was raised by his grandparents. An 1860 census puts Collins as a day laborer. So we're not, I don't know if that he was conscripted into the Navy. Yeah. I don't know if he was like a dock worker. He could have been anything with day laborer. But that was Frank. And then we have Corporal J.F. Carlson. He was 5'10", so he's almost 6'5". And he's 20 to 23 years old. He is part of a privateer ship called the Jefferson Davis. Do you know what privateers are? They're basically fucking pirates.
Yeah.
He survived a mutiny after a 7-ship run. The prisoners all revolted.
Oh.
And the prisoners actually overtook the ship in St. Augustine, Florida in 1861. So I'm wondering if the Confederates didn't intersect that ship and then that's how he ended up.
Oh, yeah.
We have Miller, who that's all we have. That's his name. Miller. 5'8", 40 to 45 years old, European descent. Evidence of a lot of, like, he had broken ribs, he had a broken leg, and a broken skull at some point. That's all we know about him. We literally know what his body can tell us. That's it. That's all we got on him.
He had lived through it.
We have James A. Wick. He was 5'10". He's about 45 years old. He was born in North Carolina in 1819. He was a tobacco user. And in 1850, he is married and he joins the U.S. Navy. And he had 4 girls and the whole family ends up moving to Florida. And he's still in the Navy. He's still in the Navy when the Civil War starts, but his ship is destroyed and he's basically given the chance to switch sides. And he says, which I'm guessing like either you can go to prison camp or you
That's what I was about to say. Like a hardcore work camp.
Right, exactly. And he's thinking like, my family's already down here in Florida. Yeah. I have to be on the Confederate side anyway, right? And so he does join the Confederate Navy April 7th of 1862. And he has ancestors at their burial. From his oldest daughter's descendants.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I thought that was cool.
That is really cool.
And then we have Joseph Ridgway, who was our last crew member. He was 5'10". He's about 31 years old. He was born in late 1833 in Maryland. His father owned merchant ships. So he was probably the most skilled sailor of everybody. He joins the Confederate Navy in August 29th, 1862 in Richmond, Virginia. He is found with the ID tag of a Union soldier named Ezra Chamberlain. Now, Chamberlain died in the Battle of Morris Island in 1863. We don't really know why he had the dog tag. We know. He just had him. I don't know. Now, a former friend and crewmate named James Joyner personally returned Ridgway's belongings to his family and actually ends up marrying one of Ridgway's sisters later.
What a little meet cute.
Yeah. Right? Here's your dead brother's stuff.
Yeah.
And his descendants were at the burial.
I love that they were able to do that.
Yeah. And April 17th, 2004, all of the crew members of the Hunley are laid to rest next to, might I add, the other members of the sinking of the Hunley and other submarines with full military honors at Magnolia Cemetery in Charleston, South Carolina. And now the Hunley resides at the Warren Lash Conservation Center in Charleston, South Carolina. So you can go see it.
I looked up a picture of it.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the Hunley website is like crazy good information.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I feel like lessons probably should have been learned, but at the same time, they did it for science, kind of.
Kind of. But also on the Hunley website, there is pictures of each of the crew members, like reconstructions of each of the crew members.
I love that for them. Pretty cool. Yeah, because you got to think they might not have had pictures of them back then. That's just, wow. Well, that's interesting. I like that.
I thought that was a good one.
I like that. Yeah. Nice.
So now we got to go to Sullivan's Island and stare out and see if we see a blue light out there.
Listen, I want to go to Charleston anyway. I've been talking about that a ton. So
I love Charleston.
I've never been. I watch a lot of Bravo shows set in Charleston. So, well, I love that. That was like a spooky kind of true crime a little bit.
So that's the triple sinking of the H.L. Hunley. Yeah.
Rest in peace to those. I can't imagine how scary that would be, but it sounds like they went quick in a weird way.
Yeah, like I wonder, it's just so weird. Like they had to have run out of air, right?
I would think, but then just sitting in your seat too, that's at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They used to hold a candle while they were down there. And if the candle went out, they knew to surface because there was no oxygen left.
Kind of like a canary in a coal mine. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I love a fun fact like that right there. I didn't know that. Huh. Well, at the same time, I didn't think about that. They didn't have electricity. So they would have
had candles. No, that was also the light.
I wonder, do candles let off carbon monoxide?
If they do, I'm sure it's minimal.
Okay. Well, then that would.
Like less than probably like an oil lamp, I would think.
Yeah. That's a history biggest mystery. That's interesting.
She's a weird one.
Well, go check her out, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.